You're listening to All Things Cage at Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and we've just listened to John Cage's Primitive from 1942, a short piece scored for solo string piano, as performed by my guest this week, the pianist Margaret Lang Tan, who long ago established herself as a major force in the American avant-garde. Margaret is renowned as a John Cage interpreter, and the piece we've just heard comes from one of her earliest recordings, dating from 1988, produced by Mode Records. Primitive is one of Cage's many works composed for dance, this one choreographed by Wilson Williams. It's been noted for its constant rhythms, as well as its minimalistic repetitions heard throughout. Margaret Lang Tan has been called the queen of the toy piano by the New York Times. After discovering Cage's Suite for Toy Piano in 1993, she became fascinated with the artistic potential of the toy piano and, more recently, with other toy instruments as well. In her groundbreaking 1997 album, The Art of the Toy Piano, she elevated a humble toy to the status of a real instrument. Critics acknowledge her as the world's first toy piano virtuoso, one who has inspired composers to create an exciting new repertory for a new instrument. Over the past two decades, her diminutive music theater of nostalgia and humor has delighted audiences at festivals around the world. Evans Chan's 2004 documentary, Sorceress of the New Piano, The Artistry of Margaret Lang Tan, was nominated for Best Music Documentary at the American Film Institute Discovery Channel's Silver Docs. It has been released on Mode as a DVD. Most recently, Margaret's brought forth Dragon Ladies Don't Weep, a sonic self-portrait combining spoken and recorded text, projected images, and original music for prepared piano, toys, and percussion by her longtime collaborator, Eric Griswold. It's been described as an evocative exploration of memory, time, control, and loss, a virtuoso collage of the forces that have shaped Margaret's life and how music has been both her passion and her refuge. Margaret's performance was described by one reviewer as a delicate, compelling balance between play and performance, while another reported that the audience sat entranced by the surreal, the beautiful, the delicate, the obsessive, and simplicity of a world gone mad, pushing us to think differently about things that we take for granted and don't question. This was Margaret's first fully-fledged foray into theater, making it all the more impressive that Dragon Ladies Don't Weep has won Work of the Year, Dramatic, in the Australian 2021 Art Music Awards presented by APRA, AMCOS, and the Australian Music Centre. The work was cited especially for its wonderful concept, engaging composition, and ever-present humor. Dragon Ladies Don't Weep is dedicated to John Cage and Margaret Lang Tan's mother. So welcome to All Things Cage, Margaret. It's a pleasure to see you.
I thought you would never ask.
I've been wanting to ask you for a long time, and there you were at the Jasper Johns Mind Mirror exhibition at the Whitney with me. We even sat next to each other, and there was my perfect opportunity. Okay. So we just listened to Primitive, Margaret. I think, was that your first CD or your second CD? It was early, right?
It's on one of my early CDs. Yes, it's on Sonic Encounters, which came out on the Mode label. It's an early prepared piano piece of John's, which I liked. I like the energy of it, and it's a very simple preparation. But I have trouble with the title, Primitive. And I think John would too. I think he would have trouble with it if it wasn't still 1940s, you know.
I see. What was the reference to, Margaret? And specifically, what was it to?
I think by primitive, he was referring, maybe some kind of tribal music or something from another culture, some primitive culture.
I get it.
You know, it's patronizing in today's politically correct world. But you see, I think John was already very, at that time, drawn to explore music of other cultures. He was taking those classes with Henry Cowell at the New School, class of ethnomusicology, music from other cultures before the word world music was even invented as a concept. So John was already aware of music from other cultures. And when he made the piece Bacchanal for Sevilla Fort, he wanted something, as he said, African in nature. You know, again, it was this kind of tribal thing. So he was a little bit naive, I would say, in today's context, thinking that way. But he was a man of that time, so it's forgivable.
Yes, I totally agree. I always remember that funny story in Indeterminacy. It's not on the recording, but it's in the performance films of John performing the Indeterminacy stories with the Cunningham Company, the early on. And he does a story about a Japanese poet, and he mimics a Japanese accent. Have you heard this?
It's so
politically incorrect now.
Yes.
It's like you want to just sweep it under the carpet, you know. He says, you know, Japanese poetry, so beautiful, maybe baby, like that.
Oh God.
Exactly.
I think he would also like to sweep it under the carpet.
That's right. That's right. He's just being silly, you know, but it was it just makes you sort of your back shiver a little bit. But go back to primitive.
Getting back to primitive.
So wait. Is primitive, does it predate Bacchanal, or is it around the same
time? After. Bacchanal is the very, very first piece he ever made for prepared piano.
Right, but that's 38, right? 38?
Oh, later than that. I think 39 or 40. No one's ever quite sure of the date, 39 or 40.
But primitive?
38 could be the very earliest possibility. It's all a bit vague, but definitely no later than 1940. And I think primitive is what, 42?
I'm going to look. I can tell you exactly. 42. 42.
Yeah, right. So let me go on.
Yes, please. Yeah.
But you see, it was exactly this kind of music, prepared piano music by John Cage, that had sort of an Asian exotic slant to it. That is why I got interested in the first place, because I was a little tired of playing the classical Western repertory, in which I had been steeped, you know, having been the first woman to graduate from Juilliard with a doctorate. But I was going on tour in Asia, and I wanted to put together a program that was different, not just my regular classical program. So I thought up this idea of a program of music, piano music, by Western composers who had been influenced by Asian cultures and Asian aesthetics, Asian philosophies. So, of course, I started with Debussy, the Fountainhead, and his discovery of the Indonesian gamelan, the Javanese gamelan, actually. And then, of course, the prepared piano music of John Cage, you know, was a no-brainer. And that's why I learned Bacchanal, which you have to admit is undeniably Asian sounding. And I had Marion de Cruz staying with me at that time, the Malaysian dancer, and she spontaneously started choreographing to the prepared piano music as I was practicing it. And before I knew it, we had a whole song and dance act between John's music, Amores, you know, Bacchanal, and Alan Hovhaness's music, which is very, very beautiful and very Asian influenced. And so we had this whole song and dance act, and I said, you know, very naively, John Cage should see this. So I looked him up in the phone book. Can you believe it? In those days, we could do that. And he was listed in the phone book.
I think he did that on purpose.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, I was in luck and I called him up, and he was, of course, very surprised to hear from me. And he was caught unawares and taken a little aback, I think. And he said, well, I'm leaving for Europe. So that was the end of the discussion as far as he was concerned. And me being me and persistent, when he came back, I called him up again. And he really was not very nice to me. I think he just wanted to get rid of this annoying girl, you know. And this is 1981, you know. And he said, I don't remember anything from before I went to Europe, which is, you know, just tabula rasa, clean slate, you know, I don't even exist. And then he really put me in my place. He said, and besides, I really don't want to see something in somebody's living room. Well, so even me, you know, even me, that really put me in my place. And that was the end of the discussion. You know, I know when to call it quits. Yeah. But, you know, fate intervened. And I really do believe in destiny because it's happened more than once. But this particular age, on this particular occasion, I happened to meet the Dean of Juilliard on the Broadway bus. And he was going to go on vacation to Bali. And I said, oh, I have a very good friend, Mr. Lim Chong Kiat, an architect, who has a wonderful house in Bali. And he'd love to show you around. And so I hooked them up. And when Dean Waldrop came back, he was absolutely ecstatic because Mr. Lim had given him the royal treatment and showed him all over Bali and really, you know, introduced him to the artists in Bali that he was actually supporting. These, he had a whole artistic painters community that he was helping. So Dean Waldrop got a really firsthand view of all this rather than a touristic view. And he said, well, Margaret, if there's anything I can do for you, please don't hesitate to ask. Now, when you say that to me, what do you think I'm going to say?
And you must have asked him for a stage.
Oh, no, I was very modest. I said, Dean Waldrop, can I have a studio rehearsal room so I can show John Cage some work? And lo and behold, Dean Waldrop gave me the 1,000-seat Juilliard Theatre. So I went back and called John up again.
Was he nice to you that time?
Well, I think I'm lucky he even remembered who I was, you know, but this time he had no more excuses. I mean, what can you say? This is no longer somebody's living room. So we made a date, and this was going to be late July, yep, at 1 o'clock. I think it was July 28th, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, you see, to meet at Juilliard, and he showed up promptly, and Marion and I were really excited about this. So here we performed for him in this vast auditorium, just John sitting there, you know. And lo and behold, he loved what we did. So much so that he dedicated my score of Bacchanal to me alongside Sevilla Fort, who was the original dedicatee. Uh-huh. He put my name next to hers. I've still got that score. It's my work score, you know. And then a few days later, he sent us this beautiful masostic, beautiful, which I, now that I realized what he said in it, that he had very specific tastes in dance, but yet he could enjoy our work.
Yeah.
I would never have dared call him up if I had known all this ahead of time. I would never have had the nerve. So it's a perfect classic case of angels, fools rushing in. No, let me see that.
Of course. Margaret, do you want me to read it?
You have the masostic?
I have it right here.
Oh, good. But let me finish that first. What okay. I just said. So this was a classic case of fools rushing in where angels fear to tread. Would you like to read it?
Yes, please. Okay, here it comes. And this, for our audience, since they can't see it, it's written in the style of a masostic. So it has Marianne de Cruz, Margaret Lang Tan down the spine in the center. I am accustomed to choreography, which is independent of the music which accompanies it, so that I was surprised to find myself enjoying these dances, which repeat the music, so to speak, which visualize it. They are imaginative, inventive, surprising, and tasteful. And the music was played by a pianist who has a fine ear and is devoted to what she does. My pieces and Hovhannes's were given excellent performances. Bad music may be the most irritating of arts, but bad dance is certainly the most disgusting. These Oriental artists gave me no trouble at all.
Yes, and he really, you know, I really think he took a fancy to us, because he then wrote us another of his, you know, notograms that he used to send out, mm-hmm. where he said, Mysterious Adventures is being copied at the publishers. It will be available shortly. So I'll let you know when that's ready. And then he had another idea, and he wrote again to us. And he said, you know, I think you should both work with sonatas and interludes. And during the interludes, Marion could change costume. No, that's a monumental work. For him to want to even consider entrusting us with this magnum opus really meant that he felt that we could deal with it, and that he trusted us to deal with it responsibly. But then she went back to Malaysia, so unfortunately that never happened. Uh-huh, and uh-huh. I play the sonatas and interviews solo, you know. And,
of course. Yeah, do you stay in touch, you and Marion?
Yes, we do. But I think that was 30 years ago, so she's kind of retired from being an active dancer now. So I think that window has passed.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but on the other hand, if I find some other dancer who's really, I feel, could work with this, I would leave the door open. Yeah. But the following March, you see, was John's 70th birthday.
Yeah. Not March. His birthday was in September.
I know, but Symphony Space in 1982, that would have been his 70th birthday. Symphony Space had a wall-to-wall John Cage marathon.
Not in March.
Yes, it was in March. I promise you. I know it was in March. It was held in March.
Why would it be in March? It was not a birthday celebration. It was just a...
It was a birthday year. It was
a birthday year.
Okay, that's why it was in March. And I still remember the phone rang and Alan Miller called up. He says, John Cage is sitting right here next to me. And he'd like you to open the wall to wall with him.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we'd like you and Marion to open the wall to wall with him.
But you did?
Marion had gone back, so I did. Yeah, and John read from his writings whilst I changed preparations on the piano for the different pieces. So we spent the first close to half an hour of the marathon doing this. It was a great privilege.
Uh-huh. That's lovely. You know, Margaret, I seem to recall that John used to speak to me occasionally about you. And one of the things that he said, I think, is that you personally felt that playing the piano was choreographic, that you liked, you personally enjoyed the movement of playing a piano and moving between multiple pianos or multiple instruments. Is that correct?
Yes. I have integrated choreography, which is really nothing for me, but the logistics of movement, you know, into my approach to the piano. And that comes around because of all this work I do playing inside the piano and at the keyboard. So, you know, I even have to choreograph when I stand, when I sit, and all my movements in the piano are very, very, how shall I say it, fluid, because, and everything is dictated by the demands of the music, which then turns it into choreography. It's never movement for movement's sake, but it's movement that's initiated by the music. And I can only make the music happen because that gesture makes it happen.
Right, right.
Gesture is born of the music.
Right, but Margaret, would that happen? It would happen less if the music did not require you to be inside of the piano or under the fingerboard, or you know what I mean?
Yes, I understand.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're right. But after that, it became integrated into my entire being and my entire way of playing. Even at the keyboard, you know, my hands are always that's all I do when I practice is work out the logistics of movement, and mm-hmm. the interpretation just happens naturally from it. And my body is always engaged, that the core, I'm always aware of the core, you know, my center.
Of course.
And then everything is connected from my toes to the, through my fingers to the tip of my head. You know, my feet, even my feet are involved. The way I pedal is also part of this choreography and is so integrated when I play that if I don't have the pedals, my hands will get messed up because it's all worked into a total full body choreography, very subtle, but it's there. And that leads me to an interesting anecdote that John is, it took me a long time to understand what he meant, but again, it's another of his little Zen koans, I think. Because here we were at Wesleyan in 1988. It was the John Cage at Wesleyan wonderful weekend festival that Neely Bruce had organized. And I had played Four Walls and Sinja Hong, the Korean dancer, had performed it with me the night before. And that was the first time John Cage had ever seen the work or heard the music, you know, played in its entirety, because he wasn't at the in Colorado Springs premiere when Merce did it, and he never heard the piece, and then everyone forgot about the piece for years. So this was his first chance to hear and see it, you know, in a realization, and he was really thrilled with it. You know, he wrote me a beautiful dedication on my cage, on my Four Walls score. Can I read it to you?
Yes, of course. But Margaret, who was your singer? I'm curious.
At that time, who did we have? I think it was one of Meredith Monk's
ensemble people.
Ensemble singer. Andrea, oh, I forget.
It's okay. I was just curious.
Yeah. But I know where my score is. Can I just run it?
Of course, you go. Of course.
Okay, Laura, I've got it.
Okay, introduce it. Now introduce it.
Okay. So John wrote on my score, for Margaret Leng Tan, who has this as her piece and plays it 44 years later, very beautifully, John Cage at Wesleyan, February the 25th, 1988, with gratitude and love. Isn't that beautiful?
It's beautiful. It's absolutely
beautiful. It's beautiful. And, you know, she liked the play of numbers because that was 1988 and the piece was written in 1944.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah. I got digressed because I was going to give you that koan. You see, let me get back to where I was when I was saying that this was the day after the Four Walls performance, and it was a world music panel that I was on with Pauline Oliveros, and I forget who the third person was. Anyway, I was really rather nervous for this because I really didn't know how qualified I was to talk about world music. And I happened to mention to John before the event started, I said, you know, John, I'm really kind of nervous about this. And he just looked at me and smiled and he said, yes, because there are no pedals. You know, I mean, that is so cryptic, all right? And nothing further. That was it. And I wasn't going to ask him, what do you mean? You know, I just left it at that. And it dawned on me, but it took a lot of, you know, dawning.
Right. Oh, it makes perfect sense to me.
Okay, you interpret it for me and then I'll see. Oh,
I think he just meant that normally your presentational self is very much connected to being at a piano, where you have this integration of your body with an instrument in front of you. So there's this whole circuitry that goes on for you. And there you were having to not have that and still be presentational in yourself. So you didn't know how to do that exactly.
Brilliant. You said it so well, because it was true. I didn't know what to do with my hands.
Yeah, and your toes.
Hello, my feet. Yes, but there's even a deeper meaning. Oh my, can we go deep into John's
Yes, please, core? I'd love it. What?
Pedals at the piano ground you.
Sure.
You know, no matter how nervous you are when you perform, once your feet are on those pedals, you can really dig into them and they ground you, you know? And it helps, you know, stabilize you.
Right, so it was his understanding of the instrument as well.
Yes.
And the nature of a pianist and the nature of the relationship. Yeah, yeah.
He was a smart guy. And he comes up with things just off the top of his head like that. You know, he's very profound.
And sweet. It's also very sweet.
Yeah.
Because it when you said it, it made me smile because it's him saying he knows you. It's him saying something to you, which probably made you feel less nervous because he was there and he understood. He got you and he told you that in a very simple way.
You know, John was very, very observant about people. Yeah. He knew a lot more about you than you would like to think. he did say, for example, and it's taken me 40 years to realize, you know, exactly what he meant. He said to Greta Sultan back in around the mid to late 80s, he said, you know, John said that Margaret is a very good actress. He said that back then, and now in 2020, which is almost 40 years later, I brought that to full fruition, to full realization with my Dragon Ladies Don't Weep, you know, theatrical sonic memoir, which is dedicated to the memory of John and my mother. But I've been moving in that
I was going to say,
for a long time.
Yes, you've been doing things that are going in this direction around your Satie pieces, your Satie appearances, right? You've been doing some theatrical aspects of your work.
And even playing the music of George Crumb has an inherent theatricality, which
because it uses the voice.
Yeah. And even there, the choreography is so essential to be able to play that kind of music. So I've been heading this direction, but Dragon Ladies Don't Weep finally was my first fully fledged foray into theater.
That's marvelous. You won an award for that.
I am so proud to say that it just recently won the 2021 Australian Art Music Awards in the Work of the Year Dramatic category. I beat out three operas.
It's fantastic. Why not?
I think it's because of my Asian roots. I'm from Singapore, you know, that John loved the way I prepared the piano.
Uh-huh.
Even in that first meeting, you know, how I prepared the piano for Amores and for Bacchanal. And in future meetings, he would always comment on how well I prepared the piano. I think it has something to do with the fact that I come from Singapore, which is a multicultural society. The Chinese, the Indians from South India, and the indigenous, you know, Malay people. That it's a multicultural society, and we live in harmony, and we draw from each other's cultures, and it's a wonderful melting pot. So I'm exposed to gamelan music, I'm exposed to Indian music, not just strictly Chinese music, you know, which I did get exposed to when I was a child because my father was very into Chinese opera. And so I think that is what made my ear sensitive in a way to this kind of microtonal music that the prepared piano really is all about. Yeah.
Interesting.
And also that with a prepared piano, you are listening to the essence of every tone, the living essence of every tone. That's what you're listening for when you work with a prepared piano. And that is really the guiding principle behind Chinese music and a lot of Asian musics.
Right. But Margaret, don't you think, I've always thought this, but maybe I'm wrong. So I'm asking your opinion. I always think about with preparing a piano that it's as much what you're not listening for that makes a good preparation as opposed to just knowing what to listen for. You know, like I don't think the exactitude of pitch should be foremost in your mind. It has to do with the roundness of the sound. It has to do with the integrity of the vibration of the sound or something. You know what I mean? So I always think it's someone who has a more open and relaxed approach or approach to listening. And I think that is kind of what you were saying.
Listening is the key.
Yeah.
And also you see the prepared piano, a prepared piano note is complex because when you prepare it, Especially when it's only one preparation that's inserted between the second and third string, and the third string is the open string. You hear the fundamental because the open string is there, but the prepared piano note has a different pitch from the...
Of course, yes, yeah.
So you know, where you place that makes a great deal of difference, you know, and you really have to use your ear and to a great degree your a sense of judgment, because John made all his preparations on a Model O, which is a smaller Steinway, you know, 5'8". Anyway, it's no more than 6 foot. I think it's 5'8", if I'm not wrong, Model O. And then you go to a 9 foot concert grand. My God, the proportions of the strings are, it's a whole other universe.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
You cannot follow John's, you know, very meticulous stipulation of where to place the preparations.
Yeah.
It sounded horrible if you did. So, yeah. You know, that's, I think John didn't realize at that time that people would be not necessarily be always performing it on a smaller grand, you know. And with a concert grand, that's where I play all the time on. It's a whole other right. challenge.
Right. But so, I also think, Margaret, that he himself didn't know how vastly different it would be on different models, you know.
Because how many times did he get to try this out on a concert grand, right?
Yeah.
Mm. So one has to use one's ear, one's taste, and a certain, and a respect for the score, but you have to also use a grain of salt, throw in a grain of salt with it.
Yeah, because all pianos are different.
Yes, you know? As John himself said, all pianos are different.
Exactly. Yeah. So he would chastise people about not paying attention when they prepared a piano, so that, and the piano suffers for it, the sound of the piano suffers for not paying attention, which he meant not listening. You know, they weren't listening.
Yeah, because even after you prepare the piano, you have to fine tune the preparations.
Right.
That takes sometimes longer than the actual putting in of the preparations.
Right.
You know?
Margaret, are you still doing those prepared piano kind of visual workshops that you did a few years ago? Weren't you doing those at NYPL? Was it NYPL? Where you prepared a piano in public?
Ah, that was something I did for Cage Unbound. It was part of that series.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that video of me preparing the piano for Bacchanal, and it's about 8 minutes long, and it's up there, and anyone can access it. I think that was a wonderful series they did. You know,
I think so too. Yeah. I just wondered if you were still ever doing those kinds of things.
I do it, but not in such a formal videotaped, you know, made for publication situation.
Now, listen, we're gonna play, as you know, because I've got your permission, we're going to play Suite for Toy Piano, Cage's Beautiful
Piece,
which I love. And it's one of, you know, it's one of the most important, and I think it's the first really serious toy piano piece that was composed. Is that correct?
It's the first piece of serious music ever written for a toy piano.
Isn't that amazing?
But you see, some people have refuted that, and then they've gone back with it. And so now I say that arguably.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. But you know, that work is for me so important because it's seminal for me. That's how I became a toy pianist. You know, that piece is damn difficult.
You play it so beautifully, though. It, you know, I get all of the nuance when you play that piece on the toy piano. When you play the toy piano, I get all of the nuance of different voices, even though there aren't really any other voices.
Well, there is suggestion of counterpoint.
Of course.
John, he was very cunning.
Yeah. It's really, I just love the way you played them.
Thank you. Oh, it's a difficult piece. I had to practice as hard on that as I had to practice on any piece for the adult piano. And the fact that he wrote it so guilelessly and beguilingly for a toy piano with only 9 white notes, that you could, I suppose, theoretically even do it on a toy piano with painted black keys.
Right.
Or a shoulder piano.
Right.
But it's so difficult. It's so difficult. It's got double notes. And, you know, he went to such lengths to indicate articulation.
Yeah, I've seen the score.
Such detail. He meant
the dynamic range. Margaret, the dynamic range is so ridiculous.
No, it's not. I thought about that. Can I clarify?
Of course.
I know what John meant. My great tragedy, I feel, is I never played that for John when he was alive, and that he never knew about this later reincarnation of me as a toy pianist. And if he does, he must be smiling from up there to know what his piece has spawned. Okay? But he did that with a serious intent. P-P-P-P-P. F-F-F-F-F-F-F-Z. I mean, you know, he made all that with real intent because, of course, a toy piano is incapable of such extremes of dynamic range. But in writing those in, and the pianist, if the pianist is a conscientious one like me, will try to their utmost to create a semblance of these dynamics, and you will get a diminutive compressed dynamic range version of it. And the piece will be far more interesting than if he hadn't written anything in terms of dynamics, and the piece would be far more, you know, monotonic. But this way, the piece has all these nuances and shapes and dynamic intentions that the performer tries to convey, and something happens in the process.
Right. No, that's clear. That's clear by the way you
So talk. Therefore, I'm very grateful that he wrote all these articulations and dynamics and everything into such, you know, infinitely fastidious detail, right. But he had a purpose, and I think I realized that purpose.
Excellent.
And I hope other toy pianists, when they study the score, will also feel that sense of commitment that this isn't just something to throw away. You know, you got to practice this seriously.
Yes, of course. You know, he said to me, he told me that, and I've always remembered this, and it makes me really just fall in love with him all over again. He said that the toy piano was the most heroic of instruments.
I love that.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes. He told you that, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, one day I must sit down with you and you must tell me all the things he said about the toy piano.
Yeah. But the most heroic, because it's so small and tender and limited and categorized in such a way. I don't know. And yet here it is in this beautiful setting of, you know, Suite for Toy Piano. And he asks for so much from you for it. And
yes,
heroic. It's heroic.
Yeah. He knew what he was doing when he did that. Yeah. And that statement from him now that you mentioned it to me, that he said it's the most heroic of all instruments. You would have to be, it's a heroic challenge that he's thrown down in terms of throwing down the gauntlet. It's a heroic challenge he's given the performer.
So he should say the toy piano is the most heroic of instruments, and toy piano players are the most heroic of performers.
Bravo, Laura. Bravo, Laura. You finished the sentence for him.
All right. Well, what do you want? Anything that you want to say about the piece before we play it? I'll talk about
it. How are we doing for time, first of all? Because if you stop me on that, I wrote a 3,000-word essay, interview on it for Anne de Fornell, so I can go on forever. So don't get me started. you are willing to stop me somewhere.
We How can much stop have? Whenever you like, but we have a couple of more minutes if there's anything else you'd like.
Okay. I'd like to say something more about it.
Of course.
Like what? I mean, you need to trigger me off.
Do you want to talk more about the suite for toy piano? Or do you want to go back to primitive?
Well, with primitive, we already talked about John's interest in music of other cultures.
And you're right. That at that time, he was active at the New School.
I have one more comment to make, which might round it out time-wise for you, going back to primitive. You know, the reason why I included John's prepared piano music in my repertoire for this Southeast Asian tour of music by Western composers influenced by Asian cultures.
And going, Margaret, that was 1980-ish, 81?
Yes, okay. It was 1980, exactly 1980.
Got it.
There was something exotic to me, you know, about the sound of primitive and bacchanal and amores. Oh, this was definitely a very Southeast Asian, you know, gamelan feeling to them. And so many people say John's music for the prepared piano reminds them of the gamelan, especially the Balinese gamelan, you know, that kind of throbbing percussion energy. Yeah? Yeah. And I think that's a very fair statement. But John, you know, I don't think he accepted it because he wasn't going to refute it. But he did write that to me in a letter that that's what people think he said. But I came to it quite independently. I was trying to make a music that involved noises and other sounds. And if it landed up sounding exotic or, you know, that reminded people of the gamelan, well, that's their prerogative to think that way. But I didn't intend it to sound Asian or like the gamelan.
Of course.
No, he did not intend. He wanted to make a new kind of music. It just happened to sound like the gamelan. But on the other hand, don't forget, he had attended all those classes by Henry Cowell at the New School, you know, on world music, as I said earlier. So he had been exposed to the music of the gamelan and all that in those classes, you know, when they were listening to these recordings of that German musicologist, Erich von Hornbostel. On the other hand, John may not have consciously intended to imitate the gamelan, but I think the sound had already embedded itself into his unconscious from having heard it in Henry Cowell's classes. So it's something that you draw on, isn't it, your subconscious, of sounds you've heard, even if you're not consciously aware of what you're tapping into. And I have a feeling that could have been part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just don't think we'll ever really know.
Yeah. Yeah, which is nice. And we really shouldn't have to know.
That's right.
I think a lot of things are better left unknown. For example,
you're right, Margaret, you know, when you say that people say it sounds to you like, to them, like a gamelan, that's in them, you know.
Yeah.
It isn't.
It's their experience, yes, that makes them say that.
And
yeah,
many people say that. So that's fine. It, you know, yeah, that doesn't mean it is. Or
yes.
Is.
And John, of course, has his own views about it. But at the same time, the fact that he had heard that kind of music and had I think, was something he may have drawn on subconsciously from, you know, not even thinking about it. But it's just part of his oral experience, sonic experience of music.
Right.
Yeah, that he was drawing on to create something new. After all, they say there's no such thing as an invention that comes out of nowhere, right?
Right. Well, but I never think of the prepared piano as being of Cage's invention. I really think it's Henry Cowell's invention. And that
Henry Cowell systematized it. What invented the idea of playing on the strings and using the strings of the piano. And then Cage put his own imprimatur on it with a prepared piano.
Yes. But I think it was in the air. I think
Cowell was a great catalyst for him in more ways than one. Yeah. But this thing earlier about not getting to ask too many questions, you know, I always felt that I could have asked John so many more questions, but I instinctively didn't. For example, I'll close with this one because this is important to me. Four Walls, you know, he wrote that at a time of great emotional turbulence. Yeah, John said to me that Four Walls was all about disturbances of the mind. He says the whole piece is an exploration of the disturbed mind. Four Walls is an hour-long essay on disturbances of the mind. He did tell me that, you know. Uh-huh. And I could have so easily asked him what were the disturbances of the mind, but I never did, never, ever. I just felt that would have been a trespass on my part. And besides, I didn't really want to know because I have my own disturbance of the mind, you know, right, my own demons.
Right,
you know.
Mine too. And I don't want to hear yours.
And everybody should have their own interpretation of what these disturbances are and then bring their own personal interpretation of it into the music that they play.
Yeah. Yeah. Margaret, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. It's been such fun. Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome, Margaret. We can always do it again anytime you like. If you have something on your mind and you just want to talk, holler. We'll do a show.
Now on to Cage's Suite for Toy Piano.
As Margaret has previously written in her liner notes for her 2010 recording with Mode Records entitled She Herself Alone, either by design or necessity, Cage wrote his charming and whimsical suite for toy piano using only 9 consecutive white notes. It can ostensibly be performed on any toy piano, perhaps even one with painted black keys. As I worked on Cage's little toy piano piece, however, I came to realize that its seemingly simple appearance belied a discreet sophistication and many delicate technical intricacies. The first and last of its 5 short movements are simple enough, each encompassing 5 diatonic notes. The second, third, and fourth movements, however, are miniature essays in inventiveness, presenting a wealth of melodic, rhythmic, and textural variety within the utmost economy and means. To do justice to its myriad details of articulation and rhythm, I had to apply the same level of effort and concentration as I would to any composition written for the regular piano. Given the reductionist nature of the toy piano, it was rather like doing fine point embroidery. The score's painstaking attention to detail tells us that Cage gave this miniature his full attention, wanting for it a polish and elegance beyond merely the execution of the notes by the performer. The most striking example of this detailed approach is the meticulous and exaggerated dynamic indications ranging from sforzato to pianissimo, as if a toy piano could have such capabilities. Cage's sense of humor and irony are at play here, but there is also cunning intent. Cage is challenging the pianist to achieve the impossible on a toy instrument, one with a restricted dynamic range at best. Nonetheless, the pianist tries his utmost, and from the effort, subtle differences do emerge. Mission accomplished. A much more refined and defined performance is the result. As Margaret has also observed, in the 21st century, Cage's suite for toy piano is now the linchpin for the toy piano's burgeoning repertoire. Indeed, the CD from which we'll be listening to Cage's suite, entitled She Herself Alone, also includes works for the instrument, either alone or in combination, by composers Eric Griswold, Toby Twining, George Crumb, Jerome Kitsky, Ross Bolitar, and Laura Leiben. Margaret has also included her own arrangement for toy piano and piano of Cage's Dream, originally written for solo piano dating from 1948. On a personal note, she has written that John Cage's ability to make an artistic statement via a modest toy, along with his musical adventures, engaging found and junk percussion during the 1930s, tin cans, kitchen utensils, brake drums, hubcaps, has given me the confidence to treat not only the toy piano as a genuine instrument, but to stretch the potential of other toy instruments beyond the nursery as well. By awakening the soul latent in all things inanimate, as espoused in the animist credo, it was Cage's belief that one can make music on just about any object capable of producing sound. John Cage, are you listening?